from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. First, in breaking news, late Tuesday, an announcement that the Palestinian government would be dissolved within 24 hours, that according to press reports, quoting a statement by President Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas added that a new cabinet would reportedly be assembled within several days. The reason, according to senior officials with the Palestinian Authority, is the government's inability to act in the Gaza Strip. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Is the new Cold War that's arisen between the U.S. and Russia now giving birth to a new arms race? After months of U.S. war games at Russia's doorstep and the recent announcement of deployments of tanks and other hardware in Poland and possible S-300 missiles in Ukraine, Russia's President Vladimir Putin announced that his country will increase the size of its nuclear arsenal this year by at least 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles. Putin made the remarks at an opening of an arms show in Moscow. The Russian president vowed to continue a major arms modernization program. He also noted that the military would begin testing its new long-range warning radar intended to monitor the western borders, with plans to deploy another in the east. He said that the rearmament program would help provide economic growth and foster innovation. The announcement came after the U.S. proposal to increase its military presence in NATO states in Eastern Europe ratcheted up already tense relations. Dmitry Babich is a journalist and political analyst based in Moscow. He spoke with Press TV's Kanish Fatima via Skype Tuesday.
Well, it's quite clear that it's just a response by Russia to the recent statements and steps by the United States and the European Union. Let me remind you that just yesterday, the Polish foreign minister confirmed that the United States would deploy a brigade, which means from 3,000 to 5,000 American servicemen and about 1,200 military vehicles on the border with Russia in Poland, in the Baltic states, in Bulgaria, and in Romania. So Russia has to prepare a response. And what can we do but to arm ourselves? We only have one ally on our western border, that is Belarus. The other countries, despite the fact that the population there is pretty pro-Russian, you know, the other countries are ruled by regimes hostile to Russia. Moldova is ruled by a hostile regime. Ukraine is ruled by a hostile regime. So Russia can only rely on itself in this situation.
Right. So, Mr. Babich, the situation will not be containable if there seems to be some sort of an arms race between Eastern European neighbors of Russia and the Russian government itself. Can the situation and the tensions be calmed? Is there still time?
Well, Russia has been trying to calm the tensions. And right now, Russia, of course, has a lot more weapons and combat-ready troops than Ukraine or Moldova or Georgia. You know, these are all dwarfs compared to the Russian military force. But the Ukrainian regime wants to continue the war because it's the only way they can keep getting money from the United States, from the International Monetary Fund, from the European Union. You know, the new government of Ukraine has done a very bad job reforming the economy. Even its Western sponsors agree that there was no reform and the Ukrainian economy is collapsing. So the only way for these people to stay in power is to say that Russia is guilty of everything. It continues the war. We continue the war. Yes, I agree, it's a dangerous situation, but it was not Russia who provoked this situation. It was the West that made the coup in Ukraine, and it is the West that is deploying now a new brigade right on the borders with Russia.
Well, I guess the main question here then becomes, Mr. Babich, is that is Russia a threat to these Eastern European countries as they get into talks with the U.S. for these deployments?
Well, certainly Russia is not a threat, and Russia has absolutely no intention of overtaking any of these nations. These are our fraternal nations. If you ask Russians their feelings about Belarusians or Ukrainians, we speak, most of us speak the same language. There are just small minorities in Belarus and in Ukraine who speak Ukrainian and Belarusian, which are very close to Russian. We're not going to attack these nations. It's absolutely out of the question. The situation with Crimea was a special one because Crimea is populated by Russians, and it would have a very hard life under the new regime, which installed itself in Kiev. But of course, the United States and the EU present Russia as an aggressor. I think people in Iran know it very well. But to say that Russia may attack these countries, it's like saying that Iran could attack Iraq in 1981, or that Lebanon can attack Israel in right now or in the 80s. Of course, Russia is not going to attack anyone.
A member of Yemen's Ansarullah-led delegation in Geneva said the group and its allies will neither recognize the government of fugitive former President Hadi nor talk with his representatives.
Those allies of Saudi Arabia, if they try and push by using Saudi Arabia's allies, if they try and push us, we will not accept that they be a part in the dialogue. And we stressed more than once that those sides, they are not part of the dialogue because they came after political consensus. We mean, of course, the government and Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi.
Mohammed al-Zubari also accused Saudi Arabia of trying to sabotage the Geneva talks. He said under Saudi pressure, Sudan and Egypt refused to allow the UN plane carrying delegations of Ansarullah and its allies use their airspace. The senior Yemeni politician said that his group and its allies would hold face-to-face meetings with Saudi Arabia's representatives if they were invited to Geneva.
Our concern is lifting the siege, putting an end to the military campaign. So therefore, if these steps are taken, then we might enter into the Saudi issue. We might meet with them and discuss with them. But I think that the main concern is the Yemeni dialogue.
Glenn Greenwald, the U.S. journalist who first published the reports on documents leaked by Edward Snowden, called allegations in a British newspaper that Russian and Chinese spies had accessed Snowden's documents lies aimed at smearing the whistleblower.
It's filled with lies. In the article, it says the government official whose identity we're hiding says that Snowden has blood on his hands. And then later it says there's no evidence anyone has been harmed. Well, if there's no evidence anyone has been harmed, how can he have blood on his hands? It's just a way of smearing whistleblowers and sources.
The British newspaper, The Sunday Times, responded by filing a copyright lawsuit against Greenwald after he posted the subscription-only article to his website as a part of his rebuttal to its claims. The widely published article alleged that intelligence agencies in Russia and China had accessed and decrypted the Snowden documents, exposing Western agents to danger. RT's Guy Anshichikian has more.
Behind the veil of anonymity, governments can do a lot of things. Spreading misinformation is one of them. All the officials need is a cooperative journalist who does not ask too many questions.
Like the authors of this Sunday Times article, here's how it starts. Russia and China have cracked the top secret cache of files stolen by the fugitive U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden, forcing MI6 to pull agents out of live operations in hostile countries, according to senior officials in Downing Street, the Home Office, and the security services. The tone is set, the enemies are revealed, all in the first paragraph. Further in the article, you will see that the nameless British government officials provide no evidence to substantiate their claims. But by the time anyone gets to question that, the story with this catchy headline is out there for everyone to see.
When you are a nameless and faceless official, you don't have to answer questions like, how does the British government know that Russia and China got hold of anything beyond what the public learned from Edward Snowden's revelations? Were MI6 operatives actually threatened? You can leave it all to the author, who has only one answer.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. Again, I'm afraid to disappoint you. We don't know. That's not something that we're clear on. So we don't go into that level of detail in the story. We just publish what we believe to be the position of the British government at the moment.
Of course, there may be those who question the article and those who apologize for retweeting it, But the story, with all its unsubstantiated claims, is still out there. How do journalists and governments get away with it?
You never had to explain anything, because we have this world of the good guys and the bad guys. And once the public considers somebody to be a bad guy, they never question anything.
Saddam Hussein was perceived as a bad guy, so it was easy to sell the journalists and the public on him having weapons of mass destruction. The North Korean leader is also perceived as a villain, so the media widely accepted the story that he fed his uncle to 120 hungry dogs. The source for that story wasn't even a government official. It first appeared in the blog of a Chinese satire writer. But one Hong Kong paper took it seriously, and all Western media followed. Whether or not their source is a government official, journalists seem less inclined to do fact-checking when they themselves perceive the target of their story as a bad guy. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chekan, RT.
Mario Draghi, president of the European Central Bank, said that he will keep approving emergency funding for Greece if its banks are solvent and have sufficient collateral, but that Greece had to accept the lender's other demands.
Liquidity will continue to be extended as long as Greek banks are solvent and have sufficient collateral. However, in a situation where the Greek government doesn't have market access, this liquidity cannot be used to circumvent the prohibition of monetary financing, as laid out in Article 123 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. It should be absolutely clear that the decision on whether to conclude the review of the current program and disburse further financial support to Greece lies entirely with the Eurogroup, so ultimately with the euro area member states. Hence, this is a political decision that will have to be taken by elected policymakers, not by central bankers. Such a strong and credible agreement with Greece is needed, not only in the interest of Greece, but also of the euro area as a whole. While all actors will now need to go the extra mile, the ball lies squarely in the camp of the Greek government to take the necessary steps.
Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras called on the EU and IMF to accede to realism, as he put it, and end the vicious cycle of austerity in an attempt to increase pressure on the country's international lenders. A day after talks on Greece's bailout ended in acrimony in Brussels, Tsipras accused negotiators of looting and pillaging Greece over the last 5 years and criticized calls for further pension cuts. His comments came amid increasing fears that a reform package for Greece will not be agreed upon before Thursday's key meeting of Eurozone finance ministers. Meanwhile, as if the fiscal wrangling between Athens and the power brokers and bankers at the EU, ECB, and IMF weren't enough, a humanitarian crisis is brewing in Greece over refugees from countries where conditions are apparently even worse. Since the beginning of this year, more than 55,000 refugees have arrived in Greece by sea from Turkey and points beyond. According to the UN Refugee Agency, support from European Union member states and regional institutions should help soften the blow. Initial reception conditions for refugees arriving in Greece's North Aegean and Dodecanese islands are reportedly worsening, despite the considerable efforts of local authorities and civil society. Stephanie Kutrix has more.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, says hundreds of refugees continue to arrive in Greece every day in inflatable dinghies and wooden boats, putting a tremendous strain on the island communities that receive them. They are mainly heading to the island of Lesvos, Chios, Kos, Leros, and Samos. More than 90% are from countries experiencing conflict and instability, principally Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia. The number of arrivals is expected to increase further during the summer when weather conditions make the sea crossing from the Turkish mainland less hazardous. Here's William Spindler, spokesperson for UNHCR.
UNHCR is ready to continue working with the Greek authorities and civil society in order to address some of these challenges. But greater support from EU member states and institutions is urgently needed to avoid a humanitarian crisis.
Meanwhile, UNHCR said private citizens, local volunteers, and non-governmental organizations have been distributing food, water, shoes, and clothes to the refugees. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The House voted Tuesday to allow Congress 6 more weeks to ponder the TPP before the August recess. House Republicans were set to take another vote on trade adjustment assistance, which provides relief for workers displaced by global trade pacts. Democrats have long supported such programs, but last Friday voted against it as a way of undermining the president's push for accelerated negotiating authority known as fast track. Unions and environmental groups say giving the president the fast track authority would hurt American workers and loosen environmental safeguards. The vote was 236 to 189. Meanwhile, while broad public opposition to the TPP finally seemed to be getting at least a nod from the congressional leadership, almost daily, world news reports include coverage of yet another trade deal involving China that illustrates the Asian giant's rise to the top of the world's economies. But China's real potential as a foil to U.S. aspirations for global hegemony lies in the so-called New Silk Road. And among the many components of that New Silk Road is a gas pipeline project that would extend from China to Pakistan. And if there's a pipeline link between Pakistan and China, then a direct link between Iran and China would likely be next, and that could be a geopolitical game changer. This past week, former six-term member of Congress and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney discussed some of the political wrangling taking place along the route of the New Silk Road from China to Pakistan with Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, Jamil Khan. This was a part of that conversation.
To start with, one had to mention that even China, why did they conceive this project? Why did they get into the huge project of $46 billion China-Pakistan Economic Corridor? Right, there were two fundamental reasons from the point of view of the topic was that Balochistan was very underdeveloped and underprivileged people living there. And also the western region of China, the central and western region of China, that is Kashgar and Xinjiang, that is also developed comparatively poor in China. And there have been recent unrest. There have been problems in Kashgar and Xinjiang. And even while China made very recently a trade hub next to the Kazakhstan border, commercial hub of Silk Road, there were reservations and observations of the local population.
So now,
that is one.
So, but now, who are these people that you're talking to? And who are the organizers of the conference that asked you to speak on such a topic?
Well, it's basically a forum, and that forum represents Balochistan, and that's known as Balochistan Economic Forum. They are the one, they've been taking up the economic problems of Balochistan, and these days, this economic forum of Balochistan, headed by one of the sardars, one of the tribal heads, his name is Sardar Shaukat Popezai. So he's the one who is president, and they have a complete board, and that's how they organized. And the basic topic was China-Pakistan economic corridor from Kashgar to Gwadar. And I had to cover this segment, which I just said, is strategic and diplomatic perspective on China-Pakistan economic corridor with special reference to Balochistan. So, and that is where I started from the other end of the economic corridor, that is Kashgar, and I was coming over to Balochistan. And both these regions have one parallel, and that parallel is people are not satisfied with what they are getting. People are raising hue and cry on both sides.
Okay,
although
now,
they are different.
Just for our audience, can you tell us where Kashgar is and where Balochistan is?
All right, the geographical orientation of Kashgar is, which is about 3,000 kilometers from Pakistan coastal area, which is Gwadar port, or even Karachi port for that matter of Pakistan. So, and this 3,000 kilometers of distance from Gwadar or Karachi to Kashgar, that already is connected with a road which is known as Karakoram Highway Road. So, one side is Balochistan, which is the coastal area of Pakistan, and the other side is Kashgar, which is across the border of Pakistan-China, and that point is known as Khonjra. That is the northern side, the northmost tip of Pakistani border, Pakistani territory, and after that, the territory of Xinjiang starts. And within Xinjiang, there is a sub-region known as Kashgar. And Kashgar is the place where there was a movement of East Turkmenistan movement who had created some insurgency problems in China, in that province where there were some law and order situation created and there were some explosions made. So China was able to control it. And yet that dissatisfaction still is going on. But basic reason, as I told you, was that this comparatively an underprivileged area means a poor area, and Balochistan is also comparatively an underprivileged and a poor area. So these two areas would be developed with this economic corridor because people from these two regions would be the two ends of the economic corridor, this huge railways, pipelines, and the road network, plus the economic zone at the entire route area. So all these things would give employment, would give economic opportunities to the people in the area, and would raise their living standard by raising their per capita income. So both these territory, one in China and one in Pakistan, of course, would be the first beneficiary, and country as a whole, region as a matter of fact, would definitely be benefited because it's a network. It's a network of road, railway, sea routes, air routes all together. It makes the combined together. It's known as the Silk Route. So Silk Route is the game-changing plan in terms of trade. So if you would recall, the McKinsey consulting firm had recently published a study in which they said that from Middle East to New Silk Route in 2000, the total trade was $16 billion. In 2005, it rose to $59 billion. And in 2020, the projection is 500 billion dollars. So that is the drift which is taking place in terms of trade. So all these trade, once it is disembarked, unloaded at Gwadar, are unloaded from Kashgar to Gwadar, and both the countries and both routes would not only be benefited, this route would connect the Central Asian. This route would also connect the east, eastern part of the Asia also. So it is covering the huge area. Imagine the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean would be connected with Mediterranean Sea and the Pacific Ocean, just would open new vistas and would reduce the distance of the cargo from 12 days to only 36 hours.
Wow,
so that is what
huge.
The difference is. Yeah, that's huge. And the cost of freight is going to be really phenomenally reduced.
So now this is a portion of the New Silk Road that has been introduced by China.
That's right. It's with collaboration of Pakistan. But China, of course, has come up with a huge funding and huge initiative. And Pakistan has to provide some of the infrastructure and manpower, and plus Pakistan has to really come up with some matching fund in terms of real estate, in terms of human resource, and in terms of Pakistani companies participating with the Chinese companies in order to complete this China-Pakistan economic route.
Now, has the Pakistani political apparatus approved its participation in this project?
Well, initially there were some reservations about the political apparatus, as you said. The political parties, some of the opposition political parties from the smaller provinces, they had initially raised their observations, and they were not agreeing to all the points of the federal government, but subsequently with more negotiations and more discussions with the political party, all the political parties, they assembled in the National Assembly, in the parliament, and also in all-party meeting, so they unanimously discussed, decided, and now they all are on one page.
Well, now, Pakistan sits in a very central location, not only for the New Silk Road, but these various pipeline routes that have been introduced as well that would carry natural gas and oil from places of origin to places where it's used. So could you talk a little bit about how all of this works into the kind of network that would unite this part of Asia in a way that it hasn't been united probably in a very long time, if ever?
As you would know, that China has such a quest about energy. Energy is a huge problem of China. And China's more than $17.6 trillion economy, an ever-expanding economy, and Chinese, the largest trading nation since 2013, largest manufacturing country in the world since 2010, they need energy. And currently, the energy which they get from Middle East, they are rather altogether, they're importing 60% of the oil supply. And all this oil supply, it takes them about 12 days minimum to take it to their country from Middle East, any part of the Middle East, 12 to 13 days, 15 days. And 32% of the gas, again, it is being imported through the LNG, liquefied natural gas, mostly from Qatar. It goes to China. Now, if this corridor is made, obviously, it's going to reduce that much of distance, because this corridor would not only have a metal road, but also oil pipeline.
By metal road, you mean the railway?
Well, railway is also included in this corridor. Mm-hmm. So one is railways. The second is the pipelines on the side of the road. And third one is the highways and the roads. So they all are in one package.
I see.
That's how it becomes China-Pakistan economic corridor with so many economic zones in different regions of the road and different segments of this China-Pak economic corridor. And imagine 51% of oil of the Middle East. Out of these 51%, 43%. Of oil, it passed through Strait of Hormuz. And the Strait of Hormuz is vulnerable. You know, it's just right in front of Iran, and it is also in front of Gwadar. And 82% of their entire oil import, it passes through Malacca. So Malacca is a choking point that becomes even more significant, and it is the choking point, which is just about Malacca, is connecting Indian Ocean to South China Sea and Pacific Ocean. It's 1.7 miles in width, and it allows and facilitates 15 million barrel of oil per day, and half of the world commercial shipping. It passes through this strait, and one third of the world LNG passes through it. So what does it signify? It signifies the strategic interest of various powers of the world in this area. Anyone who controls the Strait of Malacca, which is the mouth of the Indian Ocean to South China Sea, anyone who controls it would control the trade back and forth to China.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.